celebrates his heritage from both Guatemala and the United States. He is a distinguished professor of Old Testament at Denver Seminary and adjunct professor at El Seminario Teológico Centroamericano in Guatemala. He is the founder of IDEAL, the Spanish language training program at Denver Seminary. He is a member of Iglesia El Camino in Aurora, Colorado, and is on the board of the National Hispanic Christian Leadership Council. He is also involved with the Hispanic Theological Initiative and will be teaching in the Hispanic Summer Program in 2011. He's published 3 books and edited or co-edited 9 others. His latest book, Christians at the Border, Immigration, the Church, and the Bible, is a biblical theological orientation to Hispanic immigration and was recently translated into Spanish. In addition, he blogs on immigration and other matters. He holds a PhD in Old Testament from the University of Sheffield, a THM from Dallas Theological Seminary, and a BA from Rice University. He and his wife of 33 years, Joan, have 2 adult sons, Matthew and Adam, who were born in Central America and were raised partially in Guatemala. In the following talk, Shaping Perspectives on Immigration, Danny will invite us to set aside our concerns regarding legality and national concern and national security. Instead, he asks us to bring a Bible-focused conversation about immigration. So here ground our discussion in biblical precedent is Dr. Brown.
Well, it is a pleasure to be here, and maybe I can address some of the questions that you were asking. What I want to do today, and I'm kind of a village idiot when it comes to technology, I want us to think about, in light of what I understand the theology is to kind of walk with me in terms of what I've been doing the last couple of years. And that is trying to ask the question, can the Bible help us? And I'm going to explain why I'm doing this. Maybe I should point it this way. There we go. Let me give some personal background, then tell you how I came to this topic and what I'm trying to do with it. As was mentioned, I'm half Guatemalan. No one ever believes that. As much as I'm like, oh yeah, I think Guatemalans are usually pretty short. My mother is Guatemalan. My father was an American. And there was some genetic mishap because my older brother is 5'6". I keep one of the legal. That's where my brother is. My father was a son of Irish immigrants. And so my brother is 5'6", blonde hair, blue eyes, white skin and freckles, and his little Guatemalan body. I'm 6'6", brown eyes. I used to have black hair, and people don't believe that either, but I did. So it's just this genetic thing. And we were raised bilingual, bicultural. In Houston, where I was born, we would drive to Guatemala every year. We go to, Brownsville, across the border, Matamoros, Tampico, Veracruz, Tapachula, Tecumloman, and then up to Guatemala City. And we would spend our summers there. My parents would put us in school because the Guatemalan school year runs from mid-January to October. So I was in school kind of 24-7. At the time, it wasn't much fun. I always wanted to go to camp or something. But looking back, it was good. I got to know the country, the language, the customs. And even though I have this large body and look very Anglo, corazón, soy mucha bien. Now, that's kind of a bit of the background of my own. And so I was raised as a son of an immigrant, and in Houston, where I was, my parents had Cuban friends. And as you know, these would have been those who came out with Fidel, when he came to power, so these were the professionals. So that was our Latin friends in Houston. My brother actually married a Cuban. Then I went and taught in Guatemala City for about 15 years, and then came to them. When I moved into Denver is when I began to enter into this whole Hispanic, Latina immigrant issue. And bit by bit, began to move into it. And what disturbed me as I was doing this, as an evangelical, was that as I would have conversations with people who claimed to be Christian, the conversations weren't Christian. It was about economics. It was about the border. It was about healthcare. It was about crowded schools. And so that's when I thought, well, someone needs to start talking about this from a Christian point of view. And this is what I want to talk about today, because what I've been doing for 2 years is traveling around the country speaking at churches, denominational meetings, seminaries, universities, trying to have a Christian conversation on this. And so what I want to share with you are some of the strategies I've used. This is part of your question. As I go and I move into real faith communities, see, we're talking to the converted here. See, I would think everyone here is kind of a general agreement on where we're going. But you leave here, and you go into real churches in the suburbs of this country, and it's not that easy. Just 2 weeks ago, I was meeting with some businessmen who claim to be Christian, and one of them said, well, you know, Canadians kind of look like us, and they talk like us. So I'm going, what about the French? But anyway, but you know, Mexicans, you know, they speak Spanish and they look different. And then what was added on to that was, but this isn't about racism. Okay, those are the kind of conversations that I end up having. Okay? But that's where we need to be. We need to win those people. And coming from an evangelical background, you know, the strategy has been to take the Bible and to look at the Bible. And who are we talking to and why? I'm going to talk about three different audiences. There are audiences who have suspicions. We've already heard some of that. You see, they're suspicious about open borders and about the Spanish and about the numbers. Then there's some that are actually seeking. Oftentimes when I do speak, there's a good percentage of people that really want to listen and really want to learn. Or what happens, you know, I get invitations from across the denominational spectrum, and sometimes there'll be the main line, then what they want is the Bible. And so I'm the evangelical, you know, bring the Bible. So sometimes, you know, that's the kind of group I'm with, where they have the instinctive belief that this is right, but if you ask them to ground it in explicit Christian belief or explicit biblical passages, they may give you one or two, but they know there's much more. So these are the seekers, and then I would say there's also a group that's scared. Because it's not only the text for the people we're trying to convince, it's the text for the immigrant population itself. El texto nos acompaña. I mean, the text walks with us in many wonderful ways. And what I want to do then is to tell you that we have to think through, how do we address each of those groups? See, what are the questions that they're asking? And as a biblical person, I'm an Old Testament prof, how do I respond to that? See, is it for the first group, you know, where the question is legality and national sovereignty or demographics? I've got to include that somewhere in my conversation, because that's the question they'll ask me when I'm done. Others who are seeking, what they want is more thorough grounding, and so I've got to get ready for those kinds of questions. And the interesting thing, even up here with evangelical groups, you see, who, you know, believe in the Bible, what happens, once you begin to show them the breadth of material, usually the response I'll get is, wow, I didn't know that much was in there. You know, I'm only kind of going on the surface. Now, what I want to do in a minute is kind of give you a survey of what I try to do. And then for the immigrants, assurance and encouragement that God is with them and the Bible is full of people just like them. So the very same characters in the Bible that may have an audience that's suspicious go, wow, I didn't know that was in there. For the immigrant audience, it would be, I'm in here. I still am. So I'm going to walk you through what I try to do, and I hope it's interesting, and we'll see how it goes. Okay? Now, I usually begin with pictures. And this is Castle Gardens. This is actually before there was an Ellis Island. And so I'm trying to show, and this goes way, way back, even before Ellis Island existed. And I try to show this because this is people looking for work at the workstations there in Castle Garden. And that was replaced, and everyone knows, you know, about Ellis Island. And so I show them these two pictures, which may be hard for you to see. This is a boat, and if you were actually to come closer, this boat is packed. See, so the issue is, the numbers aren't new. You look at the boat. And then look how poor they are. And this is a mother with two children. Oh, there's no father there. It's interesting. Get them to see that, you know, maybe that's their ancestors. Show them pictures. Talk about the history, which they're not used to thinking about. They think that the immigrant stories are good stories, and they're not. African Americans, that's an immigrant story. You were forced here to work. See, we wanted labor.
Trafficked people.
Yeah, we wanted their labor, we just didn't want them. Mm-hmm. Sounds familiar. I also show them other pictures, like this is a good one. Can you hear me now? Because what happens is people start shouting at each other, and I'm trying to get a little more stability in the conversation. And I say, if we don't, this is what we get. We have people shouting on both sides, and this just generates more heat. This is where they get a solution. This doesn't convince anybody. And then I try to show them some stereotypes. If you know this picture, this is supposed to be like farmers in Iowa. You know this picture? They have a pitchfork.
Yeah.
See, they have a Mexican guitar and a sombrero. See, oh, this is what we're scared of. See, Iowa's going to become Latino. Or here's the Statue of Liberty. This is the Christ over the harbor of Rio de Janeiro. See, and you're trying just to kind of break the stereotypes, get them laughing, and then I show them this one. This is a cartoon from the 1890s from Harper Magazine. Now, you probably can't see it, so I'll point this out. It says, welcome. Here is Uncle Sam holding his nose. And here is an immigrant. You can tell it's the 19th century because what he's carrying on his back is Sabbath desecration. But he's also carrying two bags. One is labeled disease, and the other one is poverty. See, this isn't a new issue, you see, if you're trying to communicate to them. Just show them pictures.
Is the nationality identifiable in that character?
You know, it looks to me maybe like Eastern European. I wonder if he's maybe Jewish, because, you know, the stereotype knows.
Sabbath desecration would be Jewish.
Yeah.
Now, here's the other thing that I'll show them, and then I go to this kind of picture. Where do we want to begin the conversation? Oftentimes, what happens is they want to begin the conversation at the border. That's where we end the conversation. That's not where we begin. And I'm going to explain that. Because my experience has been that if they go to the Bible at all, Romans 13, you know, submit to the authorities, and that's a dead-end street. If that's where you begin. Because they'll say, look, what is in the Bible? We don't understand. They've broken the law. There it is. And I'll tell them, look, I'm going to get to the border, but I'm going to end there. I'm not going to begin there. Why? Well, I think where we need to begin the conversation is with people made in the image of God. And I want to add something to the piece that I normally hear. You're going to speak this Old Testament problem. Most people, when they talk about the image of God, will, and this is correct, I just want to add a piece to it, will talk about the value of the human person. And that is true. I don't dispute that, of course. You would know, those who are systematic theologians, that there are several ideas about the meaning of the image of God. And the biblical theology would go beyond the idea of value, because in this set of verses, it talks about humans, male and female, being created to rule the earth, to subdue it. And the point that I'm trying to tell them is this. It's talking about the potential of every human being. You see, infinite potential to rule creation under God. So it's not only talking about the value of the immigrant, but the potential to contribute by the immigrant. It's not only that we have to respect them, but that we need to anticipate and to facilitate what they can bring. They can rule the earth, for goodness sakes, you see. Now we're talking about what they can bring to the country, not about the weight that they bring to the country, which is where a lot of people want to go. Not only value, but potential, based on the image of God. And then I go through a whole series of Old Testament narratives, and I've got to believe that you know some of your Bible. If not, I'm in deep doo-doo. we'll see how that goes. The patriarchs. This already been mentioned. Abraham. But here's the part that I'll bring. I'll talk about the movement of Abram, who travels hundreds of miles from Ur of the Chaldees, and he'll make his way into the Promised Land. But I won't land there for emphasis. What I'll do is, if you go later on in Genesis chapter 12, they're hungry, and they go to Egypt looking for food. See, why do people like that? Well, they're hungry. Now, the other thing that's interesting is that once he gets to the Egyptian border and asks for permission, he lies to get in. Now, she's not my wife, she's my sister. Now, that's a half-truth. They were related by extended family. But what you see is the father of the faith at the border lying to get in. And it works. You see, so when you think about Abram, you know, this which picked up in, you know, Romans chapter 4 as the paradigm of belief, you see, what you're seeing is an immigrant story. Not only the fact that he's moving, but what he has to do to feed his family. And it's not his nuclear family. As a patriarch, he's got an extended family, and he's got slaves and servants. I mean, he has a whole population he has to feed as he moves into Egypt. So that's an interesting thing that I try to do. Take stories that they know and then show them the other side. Now, Joseph is interesting, too. Now, here's one. Forced into Egypt, sold by his brothers into slavery. As you know the story, he's very honest and hardworking, so Potiphar will make him head of his household, and the wife tries to seduce him, and then he runs away, and of course, he's the guilty one, he's the immigrant. Who are they going to believe, her or him? Well, they're not going to believe him, so they put him in jail. Then he gets out, you know the story, and he becomes second to Pharaoh in Egypt. Then there's this part where his brothers come looking for food, and they meet with him, and they don't recognize him. And then they go back, and then there's this back and forth that goes on for a while in the narrative. Now, I remember when I first read the story, and I asked, why couldn't they recognize their brother? So my brother, I didn't recognize him. About anything. I don't recognize him. Well, many years have passed. Well, I still recognize my brother. I mean, come on. Well, in Egypt, if you were in the higher echelon of the government, as a man, you have shaved and painted yourself. That's why I don't recognize him. Interestingly, as he is meeting with him, he's using an interpreter, even though he understands what they're saying, because when they leave, he goes to the back and weeps. You see, he never forgot his mother tongue. The immigrant never forgot his tongue. Interesting story. Ruth is one you would all know. It's interesting because Naomi leaves Bethlehem because there's famine in the land. She crosses the Jordan, the other side of the Dead Sea, into Moab. Her sons marry Moabite women. See, she's the immigrant at the beginning of the story, Naomi. Her sons marry Moabite women. The sons and the father die, and then she moves back with Ruth, with Naomi into Bethlehem. Ruth does. Now, Ruth, who had married an immigrant, now she becomes the immigrant. And she has that line in chapter 1, you know, your people are my people, and your land, my land, and you know, I will go with you. And but if you read the story, Naomi never answers. She doesn't say thank you. And then when they arrive in Bethlehem at the end of chapter 1, the town comes out, especially the women, come out to meet Naomi and greet Naomi, and no one says a word to Ruth. She's not even acknowledged. She's just part of the baggage. Chapter 2, she begins to work in the fields, gleaning law for widows and aliens. But the rest of the story of Ruth, and the details, and there's many details in it, a lot of people miss, is her trying to get into the community. She doesn't tell Naomi the truth in the exchanges that she has. So interesting. She plays Naomi. She plays Boaz. At the end, in chapter 4, she ends up marrying Boaz. Now she's accepted. Even though Boaz still calls her at the end of the story Ruth the Moabite, she still has the label. And then when the son is born, the women of the town come to Naomi and say, you know, she loves you more than 7 sons. Naomi never answers. Didn't say a word. But they give her the child, and Naomi takes the child. Maybe now she's finally accepted her daughter-in-law. And, as you know, the end of the book of Ruth is the genealogy of David. So you and I guarantee that that son wouldn't have the difficulty his mom did moving into Bethlehem. He would be accepted as a half-breed in ways that his mom wasn't. But see, she's part of a bigger story. A story she wasn't even aware of. See, that's what you tell our people, you see. You're part of a bigger story. And even though you've got to do all these manias and all this kind of stuff to get in, maybe, like Ruth, you will. There's a bigger story that you may never know. Daniel's an interesting one. And Daniel, how much time do I have? Because we went over.
I think you have until 4:25.
Okay. Daniel's interesting because he is the best, the brightest, or one of the best of the brightest. He's taken to Babylon. This is what the Babylonians would do in terms of their foreign policy with defeated peoples, different than the Assyrians and the Persians. And if you read Daniel chapter 1, they change their names. That's part of an ancient Near Eastern way of showing sovereignty over someone. You would change their names, so they change their names. They're also training them in the best of the Babylonian literature. They're training them in the Babylonian language and mathematics and all these things. And they're the very best of the group. But the one thing they don't want to give up, after they've been stripped of so much of what it meant to the Israelites, is their food. Let us keep our diet. And I tell people when I'm, you know, if I'm with an Hispanic audience, that's one thing. If I'm with an Anglo audience, that's another. But that's how you tell what ethnic community you're in. Look at the restaurants. See, are we pupuserias and, you know, camiserias and taqueria? What do we have here? Or, you know, in Denver, you know, this way. Once you hit that part of town or several parts, you know you're in Hispanic neighborhoods. The food. I mean, it's interesting. You know, my wife and I got married, and you know, you don't know these things when you're, you know, dating. My wife is Pura Gringa, and you know, we had to negotiate Christmas. I didn't think about this before I got married. What do you do for Christmas? What do you eat for Christmas? Well, noche buena. You have tamales and black beans and tacos and horchata and fulati, you know? My wife's like, what? You know, so she's used to like turkey and ham on Christmas Day. And so, when do you open presents? Pues noche buena.
Of course.
Well, no, it's Christmas morning. So we had to go to this negotiating process, you see. So now on Christmas Eve, we have black beans and tacos and tamales, Guatemalan tamales, which are actually better than the Mexican ones, but we get to open one present, okay? And then Christmas morning, all the other presents, and then we have turkey and ham and so on. It's kind of a gluttonous 24 hours. You can see, it's the food. And if I don't have that, it's not Christmas. And it's funny with my students, you know, some of you have heard me speak before, but there's this one thing I do with my students. I take students to Guatemala every other year. I go every year, but this year I'm taking students, and I tell them, look, you better like black beans. It's kind of like Forrest Gump and the shrimp. Remember that scene? Because it's like black beans for breakfast, you know? Black beans for lunch, black beans for dinner. You can have it. You can have it paral, you can have it con arroz, you can have it in soup, you can have it every kind of way you think of. I have to go, you can do this. You know, we can put a chipotle. And I'll say, you don't really know what you're doing. Okay. You have chipotle out here?
Yeah.
Okay. You know, I've had chipotle. Oh, we can do it. So, After about 3 days, I said, "Daddy Carol, give me this American food, McDonald's, for the sake of the Lord's name." And so I said, "Okay, we can do McDonald's." And it tastes a bit different, but, you know, we can do the Golden Arches thing. But then I say, "Look, you know, I brought some movie. We'll have pizza night. Pizza and movies. Oh, Dr. Carol. He's great. Must have always been." And right outside the seminary on the Oliva is a walk-in Domino's. So I'm like, "I'll go to Domino's. I'll get some pizza." And, you know, I have the computer again. You know, I can do the, "Oh, yeah." She's like, "Well, what I'm telling them is that in Guatemala, Domino's is black bean pizza." But it's the food. See, Daniel is an immigrant story. The things that matter so much. Ezra, Nehemiah, Esther, these are others. I use these to talk about their relationship to their homeland. Ezra wants to go back. Nehemiah just goes back for a little bit and then returns to keep working for the Persian government. Esther, she never thinks about going back. In fact, her relative, Mordecai, has got to remind her about her heritage. Isn't that what happens with all the immigrants? I mean, some want to go back, some stay, some go back for a while and come back, some never even think about going back. So what you can see as you go through all of these is a different relationship to immigration. Now, I want to go quickly here, the nature of law. Because I tell them, this is where the border comes in, and we're moving toward it. You've got to get to legislation. You can talk theory, but eventually you need laws. Good or bad, you need legislation. Interesting thing is that the Old Testament has legislation for immigrants. Interestingly as well, as far as we can see, no other law codes do to the extent that the Israelite law codes. And so there's some important implications for that because of what God's heart is to the vulnerable that you don't find in other law codes. But I begin here. Again, you got to get them laughing. I mean, if I can get people laughing, you know, then they'll listen to me. And besides, I look Anglo, and so they'll listen to me for that reason, too. What does law do? Law organizes a culture. And I always use the example of driving. So you ever decided that the right-hand side of the road was the legal way? We have a whole system of laws that if you don't stay on the right-hand side, I mean, you know, there's fines to be paid and jails to inhabit, you know, kind of thing. And then we have a series of signs with certain shapes. We came up with those shapes. And then red means stop and green means go and yellow means we're almost to red. I mean, who came up with that kind of stuff? I mean, you go to Britain, it's all on the left-hand side. And they have a whole system of laws and signs and all this legal construct built on arbitrary decisions to organize their driving patterns. And it's funny because if you go to London and if you're around the tourist areas, they'll have signs, you see, because if you're in Britain, that traffic is coming down this way, isn't it? If you're in this country, it's coming this way. So what happens is Americans will look this way and walk right into the traffic. And so what you'll see sometimes in some of the crossings is, you know, look right. Dumb Americans is kind of what's understood there. And then even how we understand law is different. You know, in Guatemala, I don't know about Puerto Rico, but in Guatemala, you know, red means you can slow down here. There's no reason to stop. You know, why stop? And, you know, it's funny because, you know, I lived in Guatemala for so long. And my brother, Lieutenant Colonel in the Marine Corps, so you can tell we're very different, Vega, besides height. To get out of my neighborhood, on the Betapa, I remember the Betapa, right by the San Carlos of National University, I could either take a right, go down about a block or two, wait for the light, and then do a U-turn, and then go back into town. Or I could nudge my car out, and eventually, everyone, you know, they'll stop, and then you go contravía, and across against the traffic, and you save yourself all this time. So here was Christmas Eve, on our way to church, our brother and his wife. And I go contrario. I mean, it's fast. My brother says, good night, Danny, what are you doing? I said, well, I'm just crossing the street, but it's against the traffic. And I said, but it's faster. Said, this is how it begins. This is a slippery slope to chaos. When I come out of the seminary, there's a light. So I teach at night, it's like 10 at night. And the light turns red, and I'm sitting at this stupid light, and nobody's coming. So I have this little voice, my Guatemalan voice, going, vamonos, vamonos. And the American voice is going, they have cameras everywhere. American voice always wins. You see, if you go into the Old Testament law, what you're seeing is more than just sacrifice for sin and all this kind of, what you're seeing is the organization of a culture. In contradistinction, in the narrative, to the culture they just came from. And that's why one of the things that will be dealt with in this law is how you treat people who are from the outside, because we know how they treated us, you know, in Egypt. But if you go to the Old Testament law, it's about what you do with dead people, and whom you marry, and whom you don't marry, how to raise your kids, and how you do your farm, and what do you wear, what do you eat, all these things. It's the inheritance, all these things. Thieves, a murder, all these things are in the law. It's constructing a culture. And then I'll take them to this passage that shows that we can still go there. But there's two challenges, and this is where it's interesting, because as we move into Old Testament law, we ask ourselves, why is the law concerned about those from the outside? What is it about them that the law is concerned about? Well, the law will talk about two major weaknesses or vulnerabilities that the immigrant will have. The first one is this. In the ancient world, you didn't have welfare systems and state hospitals. It was all done primarily, not totally, by extended family. And so when you move into Old Testament law, a lot of the help that's described is help along extended family lines. This would make sense in that culture. It was primarily agrarian peasant economy. Most people lived in small villages, and so you would live with your clan. And so you would help each other if things went wrong, someone got sick, somebody died, things like this. The problem if you're from the outside is you don't have what? Extended family.
Right.
So you're vulnerable. You have no one you can fall back on. First problem. Second problem is this. Again, you're an agrarian peasant economy based on farming and land. The problem is, if you're someone from the outside, you're not part of the land-owning system. You have no land. So you're dependent on the Israelites for work. We have the idea that most of these people would have been day laborers. So what you have then are two vulnerabilities. No extended family, no land owning capability, which makes you dependent on Israelites for protection, for food, for work, for provisions, all these kinds of things. Vulnerable populations. And so what happens then is that the law will respond to this. So you have laws that will respond to issues of food, issues of work. And it's interesting because there are laws that will say you will pay a fair wage and pay on time. And if you are with immigrants, these are two issues. You know, I go to an Hispanic church, El Camino de Aurora. I mean, this is what you hear. I mean, they're roofers, they're construction guys, the women, clean houses. And these are the two things that they wrestle with, getting a fair wage and being paid on time. That's in the law. So what you have then are a series of provisions. And then the thing that follows that is very important is why you even did this if you're an Israelite. And the law gives you two primary motivations. The first motivation is this. Don't ever forget where you came from. Historical memory. Now, kind of being honest, I was reading your thing on the plane, and maybe you were talking about amnesia in your chapter, right? Mm-hmm. Well, that's what this country has, is collective amnesia to a point. Know what I mean? To a point. And watch what happens. If you talk to people and you say, oh, what's your background? Well, you know, I'm Italian. You know, we eat lasagna for Christmas. Ever been to Italy? Well, no, but you know. You speak Italian? No, you know, we're Italian. Or German. And we've had this, you know, a strudel recipe in the family for generations. It's a secret, can't tell you, but that's why we're German. We strudel for Christmas. Really. Now what you're hearing are immigrant memories, but reduced to food. Or St. Patrick's Day, it's the Irish, and so it's green beer or something like that. Oktoberfest is the Germans. Columbus Day, the Italians. But what you're seeing is the immigrant memory is reduced to food. But it's still there. You see, when God says, don't ever forget, what he tells them not to forget is the socio-political economic memory. You were slaves in Egypt. And that's the part that we forgot. See, we haven't forgotten everything. But we have forgotten the very thing that God said never forget. We need to teach our people the history of their past, the socioeconomic and political memories that we've forgotten. And all we have left are the food and some trinkets over the fireplace or something. The other motivation is the most important one, and that is this. Deuteronomy 10. You will love the vulnerable because I do. And then he says, this is verse 19, providing food and clothing. Now what you see then, when God says, I love the alien, it's not just this non-concrete kind of idea. It's giving them food and clothing. When God says, I love the alien, he's putting teeth to it. And, you know, going back to what you were saying, how can you love God, or say you love God, and not love the things that he loves? That's all in the Old Testament law. Okay. I'm going to go very quickly. New Testament, Orlando, you hit these things, so I won't go there. You also hit this, that we're all sojourners. They call hospitality, and that really is a whole other discussion. I really want to get to, this is where I get to the borders piece. Because when I say, look, we've done all this, and would have been doing this for an hour. Sometimes it'll be a couple of hours, if they even give me more time. And now we get to the borders. But we end there. So we haven't begun there. Because you see, everything else that comes before will determine the tone of the conversation and the kinds of laws that you will contemplate for the borders. See? How do you orient the conversation biblically so you end there and don't begin there? And again, oftentimes if you're in a conservative evangelical audience, it's Romans 13. And I'll say, you know what, that's the Christian piece is found in Romans chapter 12. And as you know, Romans 12 begins by not being molded by the world in terms of your way of thinking. And part of that is socio-political and economic, if you read the rest of the chapter. So I'll walk them through that chapter. And then if I'm in an audience that's very kind of anti, I'll take them to the very end of the chapter because it says this. If your enemy is hungry, you feed him. If your enemy is thirsty, you give them something to drink. So I tell them, even if you think immigrants are your enemy, you are beyond excuse. Even if they are your enemy, if that's how you perceive them, you still are obligated to feed them. You're still obligated to give them something to drink. There are no excuses that are left. Now let's talk about all that we've done. It's a very different kind of conversation. What I do at the end then, as I do these presentations, is to say, you know, we have two borders. We have this one that is very arbitrary. Oops. Arbitrary. The one you were talking about, Rwanda. It was established through a war. But it's there. And you have to make a decision about what you're going to do with that border. That's where Rwanda was taken. So how do you perceive that border? You've got to make a decision on your political perspective on all these things. The other piece is, there's another border you have to cross. And what you do is you do this visually. You say, look, here's a border. And all this over here is what I've been describing about the Bible. All the stories of people on the move, all the legislation in the Old Testament on behalf of the vulnerable, of the heart of God, the fact that we are all sojourners in this world, the fact that Jesus begins his life as a refugee, the fact that we are to be hospitable even to our enemies, if that's how you want to perceive them, you see. The question I ask them is, are you willing to cross that border? And some people aren't. This is a border, as a Christian, you've got to be willing to cross. See, there's two borders. Not only your political decision, but your faith decision. And then the key, then, is trying to bring those two together. So anyway, I've got about 10 more minutes. I wanted to kind of show you what I do with audiences as I travel around the country. Is to walk them through the Bible. I'm a Old Testament prof. For those who are suspicious, it's to just kind of back up the dump truck and unload it. Look at all the stuff. See, for those who are looking for this because they want to be involved, now they feel empowered with the text. And then for those de nuestra gente, even now it's the Bible becomes something they can go to for different reasons. So that's what I wanted to do. It was about lived theology in real communities. So I'm open for some questions if you have any. And if that was helpful, I hope it was.
What do you sense is the reason that Israel had more laws around immigration than any other culture around them? Was it their faith understanding of this God, or were there other elements that...
See, that's a great question. That's where I would, you know, if I had... I kind of did a warp speed through this presentation. But that's what I would tell them. There's something different about the God you profess to believe in. See, that you don't find... Other law codes have the God, their particular gods behind them. You know, you can go into a discussion about how Old Testament law is perceived and how it's given in terms of all other ancient Near Eastern cultures. But the bottom line is the God behind the law is very different. The only laws that I've seen from other law codes are about work. And you can count them on one hand, about their labor. Where this is actually not about just their labor, so to speak, it's about providing for them and recognizing their vulnerability, which is the very heart of God himself. And this is where I think Orlando's presentation was so good, because I mean, I think we're echoing the same sentiment. I mean, you cannot say you believe in this God when this God says, this is what I love. Now, again, coming from an evangelical tradition, what you have is the idea of a moment in time where you make a commitment to Christ. And this is the evangelical tradition. And what I try to get them to understand is, if I were to ask, you know, everyone in this church, you know, if I'm in a church, how you came to Christ, you would give me a story of tragedy. Usually, you know, family, sickness, some kind of existential tragedy. It's fine. I mean, that's how I came to faith. In a very personal way in college, the crisis moments in my life. But what I try to show them is that God is not only concerned about your existential vulnerability, he's also concerned about concrete vulnerability. The poor, the widows, the orphans, and I can talk to them about what that means in the ancient world, and then the medium. Yes?
I appreciate your essay, the biblical personalities that you lifted up. Mm-hmm. I was wondering if you had contemporary personalities to match.
Stories, you mean?
Personalities, names, identifiable persons who could match up with the...
Yeah, I try to. I have an interesting thing. I mean, this is where... I had one guy tell me 2 weeks ago, this was the same meeting where the guy goes, about the Canadians, and it's not about racism. Another guy goes, because I start putting names to sinners from my church, you know, Mayu, and his wife, Dindik, and their kids. And so he goes, look, quit the sob stories. Did they break the law or not? So in your mind you're going, so these are Christian businessmen. But I mean, what I try to give names is people from my church, people that I've gotten to know, or the seminary. Christina mentioned this. We have an Hispanic training program, which is really the door into all of this. A number of years ago, we have about 160 students, Hispanics. 95% of them would be undocumented, and so I can give stories of people I know. But that's how I would do it. But it's I mean, you wouldn't have them, but I would link stories to particular people that I know from the seminary or from the church I went to.
I appreciate your delineation of the suspicious, the seeking, and the scared.
I was trying to give three yeses.
Yes. Could you give us a share with us an encouraging story about a suspicious audience or a person that has?
Well,
changed and shaped by your presentation.
Yeah, I'll have people. I mean, I'll give the kind of the side that they're not. And you can tell by the body language. You know, they're sitting there like this. But the reaction that I get from people who come in, maybe anti, but maybe on the fence, is usually I'll get, I didn't know that was in there. And see, that's why I take them from Genesis all the way through. It's just one after another, So that's what I'll get. Or after I've reviewed the historical piece on the front end, I'll have people come up to me and, you know, they'll go like this. You know, I never told anybody this, but my grandfather was Norwegian and he refused to learn English.
Yeah.
And so I'll get those kind of stories. They'll come up to me after a service and talk to me. I never told anybody this. Or, you know, maybe think of something, that, you know, and so I get that. But usually it's like, wow, I've got to really think this through again. That's almost always the reaction I get.
Thank you so much for your presentation. This is echoing some of the questions and discussion, but you know, one of the things that we're doing in the United Church of Christ communities is having sacred conversations around race, which is sort of geared to the audience you mentioned of the suspicious, and getting to the stories. A lot of it is getting to the historical memory that you described, and this, oh, my grandfather came from, you know, so the closeness of the immigrant experience, and then related to that, though, how certain assimilations are easier and why, and the quotas around immigration, and the, you know, the racism behind the history of immigration law. So I just wonder if in your work with, you know, with the Bible and with communities that you've found it useful to look at biblical resources around that, the challenging racism, and the way that national identities are, or ethnic identities are so linked to racial constructions.
Yeah, I would do that, again, depending on the audience, but even with an Anglo audience, you know, I just kind of went quickly. You have assimilation processes going on inside the Bible. And I try to, again, it depends how much time I have, but I try to say, look at the spectrum here. You get the Ruth, and you can watch her strategies. Part of which is going to be racial, but she's a Moabite. I mean, it's interesting. Again, there's so much here. When Boaz shows up to the field in chapter 2, he says, who is that woman? Now, they don't give her a name, but they say this, oh, that's the Moabitess. She's been working all day, hasn't taken a break. So they identify her by her work ethic. Is this not a good one?
Yeah.
And by her ethnicity. So you see the ethnic piece, and even at the end, Boaz is still calling her Ruth the Moabite. I mean, so there is this ethnic thing going on in the book, besides her social assimilation. And the interesting one that, you know, surprises people, if you go to Numbers chapter 12, verse 1, it talks about Moses' second wife being a Cushite. Well, Cush is modern Sudan. So his second wife, more than likely, was a black woman. Another one you can point to is like Zephaniah, the prophet. You go to chapter 1, verse 1. He is the son of Cushi, which means he's probably the son of a Cushite. So Zephaniah could very well have been black. So you can see, you know, these kinds of things going on in the text. The fact that when they come out of Egypt, they come out as a mixed multitude, which would probably include it because of the woman that Moses marries, some blacks out of what we would call the Sudan. And in ancient Egypt, there was a good population of Cushites because they were to the south. In fact, there was a time when Egypt had black pharaohs. So you can kind of go that way. Now, the other side of the coin that I try to deal with Hispanics, because what I try to tell Americans, because kind of the Anglo-American, is they're supposed to assimilate to the Anglo. That process happens. But what I tell them, look at the flip side. I mean, if you're with Hispanics, or Latinos, that's a very painful process. Because you're giving up things. You're giving up the second, third generation, they've lost their Spanish, they speak Spanish. I mean, this is one of the things that was weird to me. I mean, I grew up speaking Spanish, and my neighbor was my Guatemalan aunt for 11 years, and then we were around Cubans, and I was in Guatemala, and I'd never been around people who were Hispanic, who didn't speak Spanish. When I got to Colorado, it was like, I had to kind of learn this. I mean, that they had been there for so long and had forgotten, or the youth, felt embarrassed, and there's this whole kind of, Hispanic youth culture, the way they dress, and the sense of loss as you talk to the parents about lack of respect for the elders, and they've lost the language and the gangs. And I mean, so the assimilation process is actually is a multi-level convergence for good or ill, and that's why I mentioned Ezra, Nehemiah, Esther, because what you're seeing, and then Ruth, what you're seeing are different assimilation processes being described in the text itself. And what happened is different immigrants will identify with different processes that they find in the scriptures. Some have been so anglicized that they're Esther. They have to be reminded, for such a time as this. You see? Others, may be like Nehemiah, where, he serves, and that's a funny one. I get people laughing like that. I've got 5 minutes, so I'm watching it. I see your hand in a second. This is funny, because if you read Nehemiah, the last verse of chapter 1 goes, "And I was cupbearer to the king." Well, the cupbearer would be the food taster and the wine taster. Because in the ancient world, if you were trying to assassinate a king, you would do this with a spear. And so they always have the bodyguards and David's mighty men. Kind of. And then you would also have food tasters. And it's funny because what's the first thing a king will look at in a food taster?
Disposability.
Well, if a food taster is in front of him and he's tasting food, what's he looking at? His face. You okay, buddy? And it's funny because when you go to chapter 2 of Nehemiah, it says this: "And the king saw that my face was sad." Now, if you're a king, the last thing you want your food taster is a sad face. You okay? They were right here. I want to go home. What you have, this interesting story of people laughing, you didn't really play it up. But he goes back for a while, but his allegiance is to his king. You see, and we think now that the reason he builds the wall is because the Greeks were on the rise. This is the southwest flank of the Persian Empire. Why does a king want to put a wall around a conquered people? That could be a threat to the central government. But see, if you can have someone you trust build it and let him organize it, that protects your southwest economic, social, military flank. So the Persians have some reasons for this, and Nehemiah is fine with that because he's loyal to his king. He'll do his project, and he'll go back. Ezra doesn't want to go back to Persia. He wants out. He wants to go home. So what you're getting are these different processes in the text itself. And this is our people, isn't it? They're all over the map in terms of Gringolandia. Mm-hmm. And so are the exiles. And the interesting thing is, I'm going like too long, this is kind of ahead of fun, but another process you can watch in the text itself is when they do go back, the tension between those who had been there and those who were coming back out of exile. That's a whole set of dynamics you have going on and described in the text itself. That's why Ezra and Nehemiah begin with genealogies. They're trying to prove that they're legitimate. So, I mean, the assimilation process, things are all over the place in the Old Testament, if you have eyes to see. But anyway, so that's where I would take them. I mean, you can just go all over the place in the Old Testament with that stuff. Yes, sorry.
Do you have a problem with the idea of progressive revelation when you go into these congregations and people say, well, the New Testament trumps the Old Testament? And what you're saying mostly is coming from the Old Testament, so, you know, we don't really buy into that. Are there any issues with that, or it in terms of crystal, you know, making those, Christological? Or not really wanting to deal with the narratives of the text, but kind of pointing away conceptual ideas.
Well, the problem isn't the stories, because those are human stories. The problem is the law, theoretically. But it's where I don't have time, and I have a Bible, but I don't see anything else. The Deuteronomy 4 passage is crucial, because it talks about the law being for the nations around them as well. So what you're seeing is that the law and its values is not restricted to Israel. So that's where you take them. And then the fact, this would go right to Orlando, it'd be harder if it weren't such a central metaphor for being the people of God. I mean, so the immigration connection between the Testaments is not one I have to work at very hard at, because that becomes the central metaphor of what it means to be a Christian.
The parable of judgment in Matthew.
Oh, yes.
I was a stranger and you welcomed me. For crying out loud, what else did you
get? Yeah, and here's one that I'll do too, the New Testament. I didn't have it up here, but about difference. Well, you know, for Jesus' day, it was the Gentiles, but also the Samaritans. I mean, they're the half-breeds, right? And I'm a half-breed. But they were the half-breeds, the Samaritans. And so when Jesus, for instance, in John chapter 4, talks to the Samaritan woman at the well, here you have this Jewish rabbi talking to a woman. Worse than that, she's a Samaritan. And that's a passage every evangelical knows, because they use it for evangelism. So you can know about John 4. And then another one that they've never thought of, and they just kind of, is this one. You know, when Jesus wanted to tell people and give them an example of ethical life, he gives them the parable of the good Samaritan. I bet that went over really well. Well, probably not, you see. It's one thing to have the parable of the good Jew. What about the parable of the good Mexican? So that's what he's doing. So what you're seeing are all these continuities between the Testaments. So at least on this topic, I don't even have that as a problem.
Right, but I think the reason why you don't is because you begin there. Because I think that most people don't go into the Old Testament narrative, or even the narratives at all. You know, it's more about proof texting. Like what you said, when the first impulse is to bring out Romans 13,
yeah.
Right? And I think that we're in a proof texting kind of hermeneutic, whereas you begin to actually draw into the narratives and have people walk in the narratives.
And what makes it good is that most of my audiences know the narratives, but they've never thought of them this way.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So if you're playing with their heads, because they know the story of Daniel. Mm-hmm. I mean, they teach it to the youth group, standing up for your faith. But they never thought of it about being an immigrant story. I mean, so that helps too. I've got 1 minute. Now, you're a long question. So just like trapdoor time if you go too long.
All right, okay, all right. Now, actually, a question for both you and Professor Espin.
Yeah, see, there we go.
The way I like to say it is that the Christian gospel has become so contaminated by the American dream that most folks can no longer tell the difference. And what your approach does is tries to tease out the gospel from the American dream. And so my question is, for both of you, where is the overlay, both biblically and theologically, between the American version of the gospel and particularly the notion of American exceptionalism that has the prior claim that America is founded by God and we are destined by God to be the superior and supreme nation, and that immigration will bring about what they fear, both from the borders holding back that which would deteriorate what America is, and that it would be a deteriorate the cost of living, meaning giving up some of our privileges to share with those people beyond our borders, and that kind of equalization is sin in the American exceptionalist Christian theological frame. So don't ignore that overlap.
Let me give you a quick answer.
Really?
Yes. That's a great question. It's one I avoid. That's a lose-lose. Because if I start getting in a conversation, all the defenses will go up. My goal is to win them. And so I tell them, look, those are great questions. Let's stay with the Bible. Let's kind of get above some of this. And let us try to define our position biblically. I mean, if I stand up in front of a congregation and I'm doing this and I get that kind of question and I start bringing up all the dark side of American history, that may make me feel good, but I've lost them.
But that's what's driving a lot of this.
But I'm trying, in Guatemala, a lot of indirectos, a lot of subjunctive in Guatemala, you know. We've never been around Guatemala. There's always, you know, quisiera que usted pensara. It's all indirectos. You know, if you're in some countries, it's, you know, but not in Guatemala, it's all like this. I'm doing this. I'm trying to win them. Because, again, I'm pragmatic. If when push comes to shove, and there's an election, I need those votes. And I've got to push them to think Christianly. And we give those discussions. We'll sit over a cup of coffee. But I'm not going to stand up in front of a congregation and get into that kind of debate, because it's you're not going to win it. I mean, I can win it, but I've lost them. I don't want, that's why I try to avoid those. And we'll stay with the text.
Can I give a even quicker? I would say everything Danny just said. I would avoid the thing. The only exception would be if my audience were Catholics. Because I can get them to wonder what that did to our people in the 19th century and early 20th century. So we were considered pagans, we were considered this, a lot of the people who speak that language wouldn't even think we're Christian. So if I were talking with Catholics and they start talking like that, I said, yeah, I can twist the thing of saying, come on, honor the people who brought the faith to the country. And that usually ends the conversation. If I can avoid it wisely, as he just pointed out, I certainly do. Because you lose people by winning an argument.
Yeah.
It's like having a marriage. The relationship is more important than winning an argument. So sometimes you smile, yes, dear. even though you know you could win, but the relationship is more important than winning a point.
When I do the history piece, I'll touch on some of that. Because the Irish and Italians were quoted. Why? Because they were Catholic. My father's parents were, you know, Irish. So, and those of us who are older, the white hairs, we remember 1960. What was the big question about JFK?
Absolutely.
Oh, the first Catholic president. Good night, you know.
The Pope would run the country.
The Pope would run the country, exactly. So, you know, I bring those up.
He did with Bush, who's Methodist. So, you know.
Anyway. This is the book, if you're ever interested and want to look at it. This is my own copy, but it's called Christians at the Border. And it goes through the biblical piece.
That's your book?
Yeah. But thank you so much, and thank you.